This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And this is Kenai Garden Talk for Saturday, September 1st. I'm Jenny Nyman, and we've got a bountiful fall show for you. Harvest Moon Local Food Festival is coming up this month, and we've got a preview of one of the new attractions. We can also help you get in on an experimental barley operation that's ready for harvest. And are you thinking about quenching your thirst for farm-fresh milk? Goats are the easiest way to go in these parts, but they aren't without their challenges. Julie Wendt with Carluck Acres offers tips to make sure your fresh milk dreams don't turn sour. And finally, we'll take a look at an underappreciated plant that deserves a little respect.
I call it the Rodney Dangerfield of vegetables because nobody ever gives it any respect, you know. And here you start looking at it and reading about it and you find out this is an incredible plant.
Stay tuned. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. Julie Wendt and Paul Voss own the appropriately named Carluck Acres at the end of Carluck Avenue off Kalifornsky Beach Road. Thriving on those acres are livestock, pigs, chickens, ducks, and geese, as well as a high tunnel, garden, and greenhouses for growing fresh produce. The first thing you hear when you pull up, though, are these guys. A variety of goats for meat and milk. Keeping goats in milk requires breeding every 2 years, so it's not a commitment to take lightly, but it's one that Wendt and her family were ready to take on.
So, like 10 years ago, I started a job where I have a week on, week off schedule, so I figured I had time to actually do some of this. We have always kind of wanted to grow our own food, kind of local, sustainable type of deal. And so with that schedule, I actually can do it, not being out of town. So we got some chickens and a few goats, and then had a lot of people interested in getting like cheese or buying goat milk shares or eggs and stuff. So we got more.
Now, buying goat milk, it's not a thing. You're going to go to the store and just buy a gallon of goat milk, right?
Right. Well, you can, but it's pasteurized and very bucky. So how I do it, since I've got a smaller flock and since I know a lot of people who are interested in it, Alaska allows you to do a herd share program where essentially somebody buys in, they're buying a portion of one of my milking goats. And so now they own, you know, a third or a quarter of that milking goat, and then they're entitled to buy some of the milk. That's how Alaska allows you to basically transfer milk, is that the person getting it owns part of that goat that they're getting it from.
What's your goat setup? How many do you have? How much space do they take up?
Right now, since I've got babies coming in and babies going out, I'm going to say I have 25 goats. We're pretty close to that. I basically have three pastures that I can rotate them on, plus I use electric fencing to be able to move them to different spots around the yard so that they can graze. So I've got my breeding males on one to keep them separate so that they're not breeding out of season. And like I was saying about the store-bought milk, it stinks and it has an off flavor because like a big dairy like that, they just run their goats together. And you don't want the boys touching the girls because it gives a bad flavor to the milk. And then they've got the big barn. So basically with goats, they're not real particular. You basically need a shelter where they can get in out of wind and rain. And then in the winter when it's cold, I do like deep bedding, deep straw that keeps them off the ground, insulated. Land-wise, these guys have way more than they would need. But a lot of that is, again, because I don't want to pay to feed them. And I've got enough land that I can move them around.
What do you do for feed in the winter?
Since I usually have pregnant females, you're feeding them some grain to keep body condition and grain when you're milking. But if you just had goats for pet, or you know, you weren't trying to keep them pregnant, or in milk, you could go off of just a good quality hay throughout the winter and be fine. They also have to have goat minerals, which they sell a pre-mixed bag of goat minerals. And then you have to supplement with definitely copper. I also supplement with kelp. And they're pretty good about, they know what they need. You know, if you put it out there, they call it free choice. Keep the bowl full. They'll go and get it as they need it.
I don't know. You always kind of hear about goats. They'll just eat up anything that isn't nailed down.
Yeah. And that's true to a certain extent, but I think that's kind of got overplayed. Like, they'll definitely, cardboard boxes, drywall. Yeah.
You learned that the hard way.
Yeah. But a lot of other things they don't mess with.
What kind of goats are these?
So I have basically three different types right now. I started with Nigerian dwarfs, so I've got some of them. Then I went and got bigger once I had more people interested. So I have Nubians, I also have a Saanen, and then last year I also got some boar goats for meat, because some people were interested in raising more meat type goats.
And are some types of goats easier to raise and keep than others? Are there different pros and cons for different kinds?
Yeah, a lot of people would probably like the Nigerian dwarfs because they are smaller, they eat less, they can't get up as high. You know, a lot of people are worried about goats getting on their cars and stuff. A Nigerian dwarf really can't make it that far. My Nigerians are pretty smart and they'll try a bunch of different things. They're always messing around, trying to get in here, get in there. Whereas the bigger ones kind of have seemed like they just accept, like, okay, this is my fence. And so it kind of depends what you want, what size family you got, you know, if you're trying to figure out milk or whatnot.
So this is electric fence, so that's, I'm assuming, for bear protection. Are there other issues, safety concerns, if you're going to have goats?
Dogs I worry about, because goats just run. You know, they're not even with horns, they're not going to protect themselves. They're by nature a prey animal, and so they're just going to run. So I probably worry about bears a few times a year here, but I more worry about people's dogs. Yes. And it keeps them contained.
And it's not a super tall fence.
That's probably right at 4 foot, 4.5 maybe.
And your bigger goats don't jump that or can't jump that?
They might be able to if they got a running start, but that's not something they want to do. And that's kind of the difference with them and the Nigerians. Like the Nigerians, if like that low spot where I've got a tire, I can crawl out under that, and they can, and they'll test that. But my bigger ones, yeah, they probably could jump over, but they just are not as testing.
And if you're doing milk production, how does that work? How often do they need to be pregnant in order to keep in milk?
That can depend greatly on the goat itself. Some goats, you can get pregnant and milk them for 2 years before they'd have to get pregnant again. What's worked best for me is I breed in the fall. I try to have babies around March, so it's not as cold. Then still at the beginning of summer, the babies would be weaned and ready to go to new homes. And then I will go ahead and milk through until fall. You could milk longer. You can milk until they're within 2 months of giving birth, and that won't be a problem for them. But once it's getting colder, I just kind of, and once they're bred, plus then now they've been in with the bucks, and so usually I'll start knocking down their production right after that, and I'll feed that milk to the pigs for a few weeks, and then they'll be without milk, get a break, build back body condition a little bit, and be ready to go for the next spring.
And if they are in milk, is there other dietary needs or whatnot? I mean, that, you know, energy can go to milk or not, so.
Yeah, they can browse, but I definitely am supplementing right now with goat grain, beet pellets, alfalfa pellets, a little bit of calf manna, because they do need a lot of extra calories for what they're putting into milk production, and grass won't cut it.
Yeah, grass condition around here, I mean, is this stuff that you planted or is this just natural native grass?
Some of it is native in here, and especially those two pastures, we got a pasture grass blend and clover so that it would be more nutritious.
Yeah, is a regular native grass enough generally for goats, or is it a little not nutritional?
I think it would be fine in the summer for them to eat. And it's definitely fine for growing meat goats out on, like people who use them to clear their land. But it probably would not be enough by itself for one in milk.
And for meat, how does that process work? I guess if you're doing that commercially, you got to get them USDA approved, butchered, and all that stuff.
You would have to do that. And this is my first year doing it. I just got the boars in December, so I'm still kind of learning as I go. Most of the people with these boar babies that I've talked to, they want to buy the baby and then raise it themselves, you know, finish it themselves. And so that's what I'm doing. But
that's probably easier on your end. You don't have to deal with the butchering and all that.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then they get to finish it how they want. And then there's a lot of people around here too who've bought land and they want part of it cleared, you know, so they're going to run goats during the summertime, try to clear out some of that brush. And then come fall, they're just going to butcher them and eat them. So that's kind of economical double duty.
And beyond nutrition, are there other health, maintenance, condition kind of things that you got to keep an eye on?
Yeah, you have to trim their hooves. Probably about every couple of months you have to trim their hooves because otherwise those can get overgrown. They can get things like hoof rot that you don't want to deal with. Sometimes in the winter, especially it seems like when everybody's in a barn, I had to deal with mites and lice. Nutrition, the mineral supplements, making sure that they don't have parasites, and hoof trimming is basically about the only maintenance that you're giving them.
Tell me about your shirt.
So after the detection of the presence of MOVI bacterium in some of the wild sheep or caribou or moose that they've just started testing for, so now they've been able to find, some people believe that there is a link between domestic animals and wild animals with that. So basically my shirt is part of an alliance that was created by a few different breeders for education of the public, of ourselves, testing ways to work with the Wild Sheep Federation, the Board of Game, you know, try to make a path forward that works for everybody while we figure out what is going on with that.
Are they prone to diseases in general? Are there things you got to worry about with that?
Goats are very hardy. That's one of the reasons that I wanted them, is they are very hardy. There are a few diseases that we test for, just for peace of mind, and so that when you're selling somebody a goat to go in with their other goats, that you're not giving them a diseased goat.
Right.
So we'll test for CAE, CL. There's one, I think it's pronounced Yonies, but it's J-O-H-N-N-E-S. And so we test for those big three, because those are the big three everybody's worried about. A yearly, or, you know, every 2 years, do a test. Keep a closed herd. Not bringing anybody in or out that I haven't seen the papers that those have been tested and they're disease-free.
Mm-hmm. So say someone is interested in having some goat milk of their own and raising. What's kind of a sensible number and way to get into it, and how should somebody get started?
The way I got started, and what I still probably believe is easiest, is some breeders will sell you one of their older females already in milk, so that you can get one that's already producing. You always have to have two goats. Since they're herd animals, they just are not comfortable unless there's two of them. And it's usually easier to just have one in milk right off the bat so that you can try out milking, see how that works for you and your family without having to deal with a buck from the beginning. You know, a lot of people are worried about dealing with a pregnant one. You know, now you're dealing with kidding and you're a new goat owner, and that's a little much for a lot of people who haven't dealt with it before.
And milking, is that terribly complicated or fairly self-explanatory? Or
it's not complicated, it's time consuming. If you're trying to get as much milk as you can, you're trying to milk twice a day, at least 12 hours apart, making sure everybody's got good nutrition. You've got to be very clean in making sure their udders are clean before you milk them, making sure you take care of your milk in a very sanitary fashion, making sure their udders are clean after you milk them, that you're chilling the milk down fast so that it tastes as good as possible. It's not complicated, but you have to be kind of picky on how you're taking care of everything.
And then space requirements, doesn't sound like you need a whole huge area.
No, No, you don't. I would say inside a barn, you probably need 6 square feet per goat. Outside, you'd probably want to triple that just so they have a nice, it's better to go big than go small. Right. But no, they're smaller animals, and so they need less area to be comfortable and healthy in.
Do you have any estimate for like cost for a year to have a milk goat and companion? In general ballpark, I know that's tough to pin down. But
and I would just be a bad one at doing that since I've been able to, you know, barter with a neighbor for hay. I've seen estimates that range from like $50 a month per goat to $250. So a lot of it is how you're going to feed them. If you're going to have to buy everything from the feed store, it could get expensive. You know, you could be spending a couple $100 a month probably on a bigger goat. But if you are able to make do with a lot of your resources, it can definitely be more economical.
Okay. How much do they eat per day?
That really depends on the size of the goat and what stage of their life they're in. But so for right now, for a milking female, I probably give each 2 cups of my grain mixture a day, and then all they can eat of this grass, the orchard grass, and that seems to keep everybody in pretty good body condition. I have a couple who need 3 cups a day, or one that probably could use 1 cup a day, but I would say about 2 cups a day.
What other things should folks maybe keep in mind if they're thinking about getting into this?
You need to make sure that you're set up in that you have an area to keep them and that will keep them contained and keep them safe, keep them warm. You can't just get them and hope for the best, because goats like to try to get out, and if you've got like a highly manicured lawn or a very fancy car or something along those lines, and you don't have a secure area set up for them in advance, then yeah, they'll get out and eat things and dance on things that you would rather that they didn't. And that, I think that's the problem most people have with goats, is that they don't get set up ahead of time and they kind of buy it like a kitten or, you know, a puppy and think that they can just figure it out as they go. And that's usually doesn't work out well for anybody.
Thanks to Julie Wendt for the farm tour. You can find out more about Karluk Acres, that's K-A-R-L-U-K, on Facebook, and at karlukacres.com. Up next, the Kenai Peninsula Borough is experimenting with grain production, and you could reap the barley benefit. Stay tuned. Are you inspired to share your love of jazz? KDLL is looking for a DJ for a jazz music show to air 7 to 9 p.m. Mondays. Visit our website, kdll.org, or call 283-8433 for more information. And if you're missing your country kick, don't worry. Red Baron Country is just moving to Wednesday nights opposite Dead Musicians. And we're back. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. There's an experiment growing in the borough's gravel pit in Cooper Landing, and it's ready for harvest.
There was a project about 2 years ago that resulted in an area being reclaimed, and so we had this nice flat surface that was freshly topsoiled, and we're looking at what to do with that on the long term, and for a temporary measure, we did some barley trials.
That's Marcus Mueller, land management officer for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. He says the department has been working toward an agriculture initiative to find ways to use borough land to make agriculture more available for residents, and the barley experiment fit right in.
We're interested in a couple of things from this. One is to get a sense of how cereal grains do in this area. Generally, we just didn't have any experience there. And as we look at agriculture in the future, that cereal component is something that's good to have some local information on. And the other part is that as land managers, having vegetation in our toolbox for cover crops, for instance, is really important, and for us to understand what does well for soil stabilization.
The Alaska Plant Materials Center recommended 4 types of barley. One is good for making bread, Another would be good for brewing, a third is good for animal feed, and all four are good for straw. Altogether, the four plots are just under an acre, but Mueller says they grew well and have a high yield, so there's plenty to go around.
I would think that somebody would want to have some kind of a small sigh and maybe like a sled to take and put the materials in and shake them out.
Harvesting is open to anyone. You don't have to be a Cooper Landing or even a borough resident to give it a try. Though permits and fees are required to extract gravel, the barley is free. All Mueller asks is for a little feedback.
Send us just a quick email letting us know what varieties they went after and what their intended purpose was and what their experience was. Was it a success and what didn't work out well? Just hope that folks take the opportunity to check it out and enjoy it.
Mueller says he doesn't yet know if there's more barley in the borough's future, but so far, the experiment looks promising.
I think that it's worked out really well. We've kind of gone through a process of understanding a little bit more about cereal crops in Alaska and about how to do a successful seeding. Now this next step about seeing what kind of interest there is in the public to respond to the availability of grains, I'm really excited to see if folks come out and take advantage of it.
So if you'd like borough barley to be a thing, go out and give it a try. The gravel pit is about 2.5 miles down Snug Harbor Road in Cooper Landing, on the south side of the road. The email to report back to the borough is lmweb@kpb.us. After the break, we'll take a look at a plant that has traveled all over the world and developed a history as interesting as its agricultural possibilities.
Have you ever wondered how much fish we sell on the Kenai, or how much oil comes from here, what it's all worth, and what it all means? Well, we have too. That's why we created Econ 919, a weekly look at the Kenai Peninsula's economy, what makes it work, and who makes it work. Tune in each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for new numbers, emerging trends, and a bit of trivia. Econ 919, Friday mornings at 9 and again at 5, right here on KDLL, public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
Welcome back to Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and I am here to convince you to show a little love to the much maligned rhubarb.
Be nice to it, it'll be nice to you. You know, Alaska farmers are always looking for a niche plant. You know, with the peonies, with some of the brassicas, you know, the cauliflower and whatnot, they're always looking for something we can do that nobody else can do quite the way we do it. And I think rhubarb is one of those.
Actually, Dave Ionson is going to do the convincing. Dave is a soil scientist with the Kenai Field Office of the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. But before that, he was the curator at the Agriculture Research Service's Arctic Plants Gene Bank in Palmer. Of the many Arctic-adapted plants he tested and conserved at the ARS station was a world-class collection of 69 different types of rhubarb. When the Alaska Field Station shut down around 2012, he got a call asking if he wanted to save the collection before it got plowed under. He juggled locations for a couple of years before finding a new home for the plants in his new home of the Kenai Peninsula, on Robert and Renee Wall's Wilderness View Farms in Sterling.
My husband, Robert Wall, and I live here. He's lived here since the early 80s, and we have quite a bit of land here, and he wanted to do something with it. So after some research, we decided on rhubarb.
And why rhubarb?
Well, he's quite busy with his work, so it was something that we could handle with that kind of schedule. Also, the moose don't eat it. We didn't have an area fenced in, so low maintenance, and it grows great here. You don't have to do anything with it. It'll just lay down and hibernate for the winter. If you don't have to harvest it, if you don't get to it, it's okay.
And what do you do with your plants?
So far, we've sold it to some local restaurants and wineries. We hope to market it further than that, but that's where we're at right now.
How many plants or acreage do you have?
So far, we have a half acre, and we have about 500 plants.
And how long have you been growing them?
We planted these in 2013.
And then Dave, you had plants that were on the chopping block if you didn't find a home for them. How'd they end up here?
Well, I got to talking with Renee and Robert, and they said, hey, we're growing rhubarb, you know, you can park them at our farm. And I said, sure. So Renee and Robert and I went up to Palmer and got them out of the university. And with the help of these two, we brought them all back, and Renee and Rob stuck them out there.
Is rhubarb native to Alaska at all? Are there any varieties up here?
No. Well, that's the fun part. Rhubarb was brought to North America by Benjamin Franklin in 1782. He brought it over from Europe. Rhubarb, you know, I said we've been growing it for 5,000 years. It's only been since the 1780s that anybody worried about the tops of it, the petioles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before that it was grown as a medicinal. For 4,800 years it was grown as a medicinal.
And people use the roots or the...
The roots.
Oh.
So if you went to China and asked them about rhubarb pie, they wouldn't know what you were talking about.
I wonder who and the leaves are poisonous, right? So I wonder who the first person was that decided, like, I'll give these stems a try.
Well, that happened in Europe. And just about the time that these guys brought it to North America, they decided, you know, that they're going to throw sugar at it. So they started doing that. But this gets me to my point. So rhubarb is native to China, what you would call Shangri-La, the foothills of the Himalayas.
Okay.
It migrated in the 9th century. Muslim sailors brought it around India up through... They brought it up through the Middle East, okay? So that's one route that it made it to Europe. Another route, and this is really cool, it's another testament to how cool rhubarb is. Marco Polo, if you read his book, Travels to China, you will see Marco Polo brought rhubarb to Europe via Italy. And the third route is a northern route through Russia. And there was a time in the 1560s that if Jenny Nyman was living in Russia and had the wrong rhubarb, they could put you to death.
Wow.
Because they were trying to control the market to Europe. And so, yeah, it was a real no-no not to have the right rhubarb in Russia. And at the same time, darn near the same time, Russia and China almost went to war over rhubarb. I call it the Rodney Dangerfield of vegetables because nobody ever gives it any respect, you know. And here you start looking at it and reading about it and you find out this is an incredible plant. You know, it's been around forever.
Well, and you said it originally was used for medicinal purposes. What did it treat or what did they...
What did it treat? I knew that question was coming.
Or what did they think that it treated might be a better question.
They knew what it treated. They knew it's a purgative.
As in,
Jenny better hope somebody doesn't lock the bathroom door.
I was trying to think of a delicate way of phrasing that. That works. Okay.
Yeah. It's a purgative. The diet in Western Europe during the centuries that it was used was very heavy in animal fats. And so, quite literally, Western Europe was suffering from constipation. And it just so happens that rhubarb is a really good rhubarb root. From Rheum officinalis, the Chinese rhubarb, is a very good cure for that. And that's why it was so valuable to everybody.
And whoever that first person was that goes, maybe I'll try the stalks. Why not?
I think it had to be Norwegians myself. You know, Norwegians are... They like to throw sugar at things they don't understand, so...
Well, why wouldn't you?
Anyway... That's its history. That's how it got to Europe. But it also came the other way. The Russians brought it to Kodiak back, I think they brought it back in about mid-1700s. They brought it to Kodiak, and one of these out here that Renee has is one called a Yakulik. And a Yakulik was one that we got from Kodiak. So it could very well be an offspring of the first rhubarb on the west coast of North America.
Oh, cool.
I think that's really cool.
Can we maybe go take a tour of the field and you can kind of point out some of the different varieties?
Yeah.
And is this your section here, Dave? Or is this Renee's?
It's my rhubarb, but Renee and Robert are going to benefit from anything that's culinary. Okay, I just wanted a place to stick it so that it didn't get turned under at the university.
So that section there is ours.
What kind do you have?
I think it's Rheum hybridum is one I think it is. And it's really tough. Rhubarb is very tough because it, for one thing, it does not breed true to the parents. Because you can have two rhubarbs and cross them with certain characteristics that you're after, and their seed, the morphology that comes out of that seed, may not be anything like the parents at all. That's what it means to not breed true to your parents.
How does that work? Where are they getting the genetics from for however they end up?
I have no idea. I've got a phylogenetic tree in my, which is a genetic table in my car showing how similar these things all are. Hmm. But it's sometimes it's the effect of different soil chemistry. I mean, it could be affected by the way the different nutritional regime, you know. If you change your nutritional regime, your rhubarb may very well change morphologically. It may go from being very upright to being very prostrate.
So it's not a genetic characteristic as much as a
cultural characteristic or a soil chemistry characteristic.
So your own little rhubarb plant in your yard is pretty unique to you, or could be, potentially.
Yeah, it could be very unique to you and your situation.
So these that we're looking at right now are planted through some weed cloth. Is that a necessary or recommended thing, or is that...
It makes weeding a lot easier.
Okay.
In the inner zone.
In our section, we planted a certain type of grass in between the rows that doesn't spread underground with rhizomes.
Oh.
It only spreads by seed, and so we just keep it mowed, and that way it doesn't spread everywhere, but yet it helps block the weeds out, and we can mow it.
When you're buying rhubarb plants or somebody gifts you rhubarb plants, they can look different around here. Some have the really nice red stalks, some are kind of greenish,
right.
Some are... Are there some better than others, or are there certain characteristics that would be indicative of a plant that's going to do well for you if you're kind of getting your first one?
A Brix reading, the sugar content of the stem, trying to look for a Brix reading of 5 or above, and that tells me it's a sweeter... I mean, as if rhubarb could be sweet. I mean,
true. Relatively.
Relatively sweet. It's sweet compared to more tart rhubarbs.
Okay.
Yeah, so you use that Brix reading. As far as color, that's the other thing I try to get people to understand, is there is absolutely no correlation between Brix reading and color. There's no correlation at all between sugar content and color. Everybody thinks that the strawberry rhubarb is so red, it's got to be really sweet. And there's no published evidence to support that.
So how do you know when it's ready to harvest then, if not by color?
I start to come out and look for the seed stalk, because I know if they're starting to put energy into that seed stalk, they're ready to go. The first thing I do is take the seed stalk off, because if they're putting it into there, they're not putting it into the leaves.
Right.
And there's, like I said, because they don't breed true to the parent, there's no point in collecting the seed and replanting it. That's why everybody reproduces rhubarb by clones rather than seed. And Renee can tell you, do you guys harvest from the outside in?
We do. Yeah. Well, we leave the very outside leaves as a weed control. So they stay down and they cover the weeds or grass or whatever is there. And then we take from there on in.
Is there any recommended method for harvesting? I've heard some people recommend, you know, you should cut it. Some people say pull. Some people say twist. There's varieties.
I say pull and twist. I don't believe in cutting them. And one of the reasons is, like, if you took a knife and cut that and you didn't take and stick your knife into some weak Clorox solution, you'd just transport that virus right down the line.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Which I think is one of the biggest reasons I don't cut them.
Heard too, is you can comment on this, is that if you leave some of the stalk there, that rot could start at the little bit of rhubarb that's left on that stalk and
right.
Travel down into the crown.
So care of rhubarb. I think the assumption is just leave it alone and it'll be fine. A nuclear bomb. Cockroaches and rhubarb will rule the world, which may be kind of true. They are definitely very hardy, but there are definitely things you can do to help it along. So if you want healthy year after year rhubarb.
Cultivatable rhubarb.
There you go.
Then you have to take care of it. I mean, you have to weed it. You have to do what Renee and Rob are doing. Preclude the weeds somehow. Although I've found, and Renee will probably echo this, that if you grow the leaves big enough, they shade out a lot of weeds.
Self-weeding. Wow, that's handy. Yeah.
And a lot of people, what I used to do was when I'd pull the stalk, I'd cut the leaf off and throw the leaf in the middle of the alleyway as an insecticide because the leaves contain oxalic acid, which is an irritant for insects. A lot of insects. There are some that'll still attack it, but I get all these stories about how you can mistreat rhubarb and it'll still grow for you. And my comeback to that is, yeah, it'll survive, but will it thrive? And what I've found through research on rhubarb is that if you give it just a little TLC, it will go nuts for you in Alaska. You know, one of the things that people kept saying was, okay, rhubarb always shuts down in the summer and it gets droopy, whatnot. And I found that if you keep watering it and keep fertilizing it, it won't do that, you know. So I could harvest good turgid rhubarb all the way into the first frost.
You mentioned watering and fertilizing. What should folks do there?
If you're organic, go with a lot of compost. A shovel full of that into every hole that you go to put your rhubarb in would be really nice. You'd have to probably put it in again once you divide. In about 5 years, you'd have to do it again. I watered them. People aren't going to believe this, but I put 16 gallons a week per plant.
What?
And I never had any problem with rot. Rhubarb is a much bigger water user and nutrient user than people think. Everybody cultivates by benign neglect up here, and if they spent some time and actually tried to cultivate it, like I said, the results would be amazing.
We do have a drip irrigation on this, on our section, and we're doing 2 gallons a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's really helped. Last year we did 1 gallon a day, and it definitely helped that increased water this year.
Right.
And we also planted in Fritz's compost.
Well, and as a wasp just buzzed by us, are pests an issue at all for rhubarb? Slugs or voles or anything like that you got to look out for?
Have you seen slugs?
A few, a small number, but nothing that has left, I've heard stories. Some people have told me about lots of slug slime trails on their rhubarb, and we just haven't seen that.
I never had any kind of insect problems. There's one called rhubarb curculio, which is like a larval thing, an insect larva that people get, and they've reported it in the lower 48, but I never saw it up here. The only thing that I ever saw that could be considered a pest other than the weeds is this viral infection, if you could consider that. Because it really wreaked havoc on the Kerwin that we had, the Kerwin accession. It hasn't done it to this one. But they'll usually grow out of it too. So it's not really a problem. And I mean, you can see it right here. So this is not a problem.
So you mentioned splitting them. Why do that? How often do that? What's the purpose?
The dogma is, among people that grow it and do research on it, is that it should be every 5 to 8 years. And certainly when you start to see the heart rot develop.
In the middle of the plant,
right.
The stalks in the middle,
right.
And the core just kind of starts getting rotten. And you'll still get stalks around the outside, but
right.
It's empty in the middle. Okay.
Yep. And you can tell, you'll run a shovel through it and it'll just be black. The inner part of the crown will just be black and kind of mushy. I mean, it's rotted essentially, but it rots from the inside out.
And you just take a shovel split it right down the middle?
Or like I said, I've gotten 60 clones off of one crown. So
oh my God.
You don't need to just cut it in half. You can take, I call them the little nubbins, the little bud. And if you get as little, I mean, you can get as little as 1 cubic inch of root and have it grow, but I usually go a little bigger than that.
Okay.
But you find those little nubbins that come up in the early spring. It's just a little red head coming up out of the ground, and yeah.
If you have at least one leaf with that bit of root.
That's all it takes. You can just cut that off and replant it somewhere else, and mm-hmm. Brand new rhubarb plant. Okay. And what time of year is best to do that?
I try to get out there as soon as the ice is gone, because they'll be up. I mean, you'll see rhubarb comes up faster than anything else.
Okay.
It'll be out there with snow around it, and you'll still start to see those buds coming up.
When we first got ours, though, it was the middle of July, to be honest, when we were planting, so they made it.
Yeah.
And then the other end of the season, of course, winter. Like you're saying, you don't have to do anything with them to winter them over, but is there anything helpful you could do if you wanted to show the poor sad rhubarb a little love?
Now you're talking to the guy that had federal funding to grow it. I ordered in a whole bunch of straw, and I had a slight depression around each rhubarb plant when I put them in, and I put 4 inches of straw over the top of every crown, and then had my technicians shovel dirt on the edges of it. So I had that kind of fabric every rhubarb plant, every one of the 690, a little square of weed fabric with 4 inches of straw under it.
Dang.
You don't need to do that. It's like Renee says, you know, you can kind of walk away from, although I would at least put straw over them, you know. Maybe if I was doing it now, I'd put one strip of weed fabric down the middle and then cover it with dirt and then just kind of sprinkle in some straw, just something to give it a little insulation from, especially if you're not getting snow.
And Renee, have you ever had any problems with any of your plants?
We haven't. And we've had some wildly varying winters. You know, sometimes all our snow has been gone in January but then it comes back. But no, we've had all our plants come back.
And what's your favorite thing to do with rhubarb?
I've had it on pizza instead of mushrooms.
Really?
Yeah, everybody goes with the sugar thing, but there are a lot of savory recipes out there also. I've had rhubarb chili that had beets for color, no tomatoes in it. And we served it at the fair, actually. Our district served it at the fair. It was really good. It won the Rhubarb Rumble about 3 years ago in Palmer. Huh. And I've had it from the same guy. He came in with one day, and we were talking about different ways of doing rhubarb. And I said, you know, I wonder if anybody ever thought of putting rhubarb on pizza. And he got this gleam in his eye. This is John Erickson, who runs Pizzeria Delphi up in Palmer. And he ran out of the building, and he came back a little bit later, and he said, I put it on garlic crust. He said, because I thought about the marinara, and he said, I thought it'd be just way too tart to mix it with tomato sauce. So I mixed it with garlic butter sauce, and it was really good. So instead of mushrooms, it was rhubarb.
Interesting.
And I've had it as salsa. Bruce Bush's wife, Victoria, makes a beautiful salsa, a chutney, rhubarb chutney with salmon. Just look for different things, you know, look for something that needs a little bit of pizzazz. I've had rhubarb pilsner. Very good. I've had rhubarb sparkling wine with strawberry. The problem there is that if you needle in too much strawberry juice, you wind up with something that's overpoweringly strawberry. And you put it with something that doesn't have quite the sweet kick to it that the other ones do. And that pilsner was very dry and very nice.
Hmm. Renee, what about you? What's your preferred rhubarb preparation?
Gosh, I want to get creative and try all these. I haven't tried as many as I want, but I have had Sea Alaska Berries makes a rhubarb wine, and they don't mix it with anything, and it is really good. It's like a Chardonnay. You wouldn't really know it's rhubarb. It has a very, very faint rhubarb taste, but it's, you know, a clear wine. It's not red. It's just a clear, like a Chardonnay. And of course, I just like the traditional rhubarb pie and rhubarb crisp with ice cream. It's my go-to.
Yep.
Thanks for representing for the rest of us that haven't had the pizza and whatever else.
You can pickle it too.
Oh,
that's one thing I want to try.
Yeah. It's really well. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are there other things you think folks should know about the poor maligned rhubarb?
Be nice to it, it'll be nice to you. I think that it, you know, Alaska farmers are always looking for a niche plant. You know, with the peonies, with some of the brassicas, you know, the cauliflower and whatnot, they're always looking for something we can do that nobody else can do quite the way we do it. And I think rhubarb is one of those. Doesn't take very much splitting before you've got this entire field full of rhubarb. If Alaskans actually paid attention to it like they do other crops, we'd have the world market on rhubarb, you know, because it just loves our conditions. A lot of organic matter, good drainage, and it just goes nuts. You know, I've had some that with stalks bigger than my wrist. I got big wrists, you know.
All right, it's time for rhubarb's day in the sun, although it sounds like it would probably prefer rain anyway.
Yeah.
Thanks to Dave Ionson for his extensive rhubarb knowledge, and Renee Wall of Wilderness View Farms in Sterling. Coming up, Harvest Moon Local Food Festival is right around the corner, and we'll have a preview right after this break. Calling all KDLL listeners. Would you like to have a direct voice into what you hear on the air? KDLL is seeking members for its Community Advisory Board. The CAB meets quarterly to gather public input and evaluate how well KDLL programming meets the needs of the community. If this gets your ring of approval, contact Jenny at KDLL at info@kdll.org or 283-8433. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. You're listening to Kenai Garden Talk. I'm Jenny Nyman. The 6th annual Harvest Moon Local Food Festival takes place September 8th through the 15th in the central Kenai Peninsula. And there's a new group activity to look forward to. KDLL's Jay Barrett spoke with Heidi Che, the district manager of the Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District, about a bus tour of local farms, which kicks off Local Food Week.
Well, we've done small farm tours in the past. This is kind of the bigger, better, deluxe version, and we are partnered up. Kenai Soil and Water is partnered up with Kenai Local Food Connection, Janice Chumley at the Cooperative Extension, and Alaska Farm Tours to do a three-stop sort of deluxe overview of exciting developments in farming here on the Central Peninsula.
So there is an actual company that gives tours of farms?
There is. Alaska Farm Tours started several years ago, and they offer, what they found is that there's a growing trend in agritourism. And I had Margaret Adsett, who's the founder of Alaska Farm Tours, come down last spring, and we invited the local visitor industry and local farms to hear Margaret talk about this growing interest that people have in actually going to farms and seeing the work there and, seeing not only food production, but agriculture of all kinds up close. And Alaska's agriculture, as you know, is very unique. So Margaret has had quite a bit of success doing farm tours all summer long, all in Palmer and Talkeetna. And this will be the first time that we have such a tour in the Kenai-Soldotna area. So we've partnered it up with her to help with the advertising and the ticket sales. And Margaret will also be on hand on this inaugural voyage. We have a local tour guide, however, who knows the three farms that are included on the tour really well.
I'm looking on the website for the tour here, a 53-passenger bus, and you're going to drive them around all these tours. That's going to be great.
Well, the idea started, you know, we see this bus around town. We've used it. I, working with other groups, have used the bus idea to get people around from site to site, with the Alaska Solar Tour, for instance. And it seemed like it would be a great, fun way to showcase what's happening with our small-scale agriculture. And when you're on the bus together, it provides you an opportunity to talk and visit and share information between the stops as well.
Yeah. I see that it's about 4 hours, but it includes a wine tasting.
That is true. We've lined it up So the three stops are all around the Kenai-Soldotna loop. Each farm is unique in its own way. The first one produces loads of vegetables and honey and jam and eggs and livestock. The second one, lots of high tunnels. And then the third one is our locally getting better and better known all Alaska grown winery. And we'll be having a tour of the farm there and then a wine tasting. Lancashire Farms, Ridgeway Farms, and Alaska Berries are the stops.
Oh, terrific. And I imagine that this is going to be popular. Is there a deadline for signing up for the farm tour?
We'll be selling tickets up until the day of. We do have a capacity limit of 50 on the bus. There will be no ticket sales on the day of, and for planning purposes, it would be much better for us if people had purchased their ticket well before September 5th. The tour itself is on September 8th. It starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and finishes back in Soldotna at 5:30.
Next Saturday's farm tour is just one of many events during Harvest Moon Local Food Week. There's a wild edibles hike from 1 to 3 p.m. next Sunday, September 9th. Meet at Mile 7 of Funny River Road to learn about the wild edibles of the forest. On Tuesday, September 11th, there's a berry identification walk from 4:30 to 6 p.m. Meet at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank for a brief introduction to local berries with the Cooperative Extension Service, then take a guided berry walk on nearby trails. The Harvest Moon keynote talk will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, September 14th, at the Soldotna Library. Bruce Wrigley, founder of Alaska Flower Company, will talk about Alaska's path to food security. Finally, on Saturday, September 15th, the Harvest Moon Local Food Festival is held from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Soldotna Creek Park, with farm vendors, local music, activities for kids, guest speakers, cooking demonstrations, a Preserving the Harvest tent, and food trucks featuring local ingredients. For more information on the festival, visit kenailocalfood.org. Farmers markets are winding down for the season. Wednesday market wrapped up last week. Today is the last day of the Kenai Saturday market, open until 5 p.m. in the parking lot of the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. The Soldotna Saturday Market is open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. today and next Saturday. They're in the bus turnaround on East Corral Avenue. And the Farmers Fresh Market at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank is open from 3 to 6 p.m. this Tuesday and September 11th. You can still order farm fresh local food online through October on the Alaska Food Hub site, with weekly pickups Wednesdays at Soldotna Christ Lutheran Church. Find out more about that at alaskafoodhub.org. O'Brien Garden and Trees in Nikiski has a mid-season apple tasting coming up from 2 to 4 p.m. September 16th. They're on Frida Drive in Nikiski and on Facebook at O'Brien Garden and Trees. And that'll do it for this episode of Kenai Garden Talk. You can find a podcast version of this show and all our previous shows on the Kenai Garden Talk page on kdll.org. Our quote for the month is by Robert Louis Stevenson. Don't judge each day by the harvest you reap, but by the seeds you plant. That being said, here's hoping you have a happy, full harvest. I'm Jenny Nyman. Thanks for tuning in.